Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. So many of our listeners ordered The Last Coat when the company set up this special offer for Everyone Loves Guitar listeners. The company wanted to make this offer available one more time again, just for listeners of Everyone Loves Guitar. So if you didn't get a chance to take advantage of it last month, you're getting one more chance to get free bottles of this breakthrough nanotechnology, so listen up.
Hey guys, this is Craig. First of all, I'm really thrilled to tell you about this next advertiser because the owner and I have been friends for close to 10 years. And when I say friends, I don't mean Facebook friends. We're actually good friends. We've been to each other's homes. Our families have eaten meals together and I've carried his kids in my arms when they were babies. And even more important to you, he's got a killer product on the cutting edge of technology. So if you drive a car, truck, or motorcycle, or if you play guitar or any other stringed instrument, then pay really close attention to what I'm about to tell you. Because I want to talk to you about The Last Coat. The Last Coat is a proprietary formula that lets you wash, polish, and put a protective coating on your car. It's based on hydrophobic liquid glass nanotechnology, which is an advanced and environmentally safe technology that actually protects any surface, including guitars. The product's manufactured right here in the United States. All you do is apply it once, and it creates an ultra-thin layer which protects your car's surface for 6 months under any kind of dry driving conditions. Your car looks like you've spent basically all day washing and waxing it, not the 20 minutes it actually takes you. Then anytime your car gets dirty over the next 6 months, just wash it off and you'll see the water beading up on there and then wipe it down. And that same protective shiny coating that you have after applying it will still be there. It provides protection from rain, sleet, or snow, and there's no more dirty water residue. And on top of everything else, the Last Coat is 100% guaranteed to work. Meaning if you're unsatisfied with The Last Coat for any reason at all, or if it fails to live up to any of its claims, just send the product back. They'll give you a full refund, no headaches, no hassles, anytime for 365 days after you order it. And here's the really cool stuff. The Last Coat also works just as well on guitars, basses, countertops, mirrors, anything wood or pretty much any surface at all. I've used it on all my guitars, including my 335, and they're literally mint. To get this product, which includes free travel size bottles for your guitar that fit right inside your guitar case, along with free microfiber towels. And on top of that, if you use the coupon code ELG15, you're also going to get another 15% off. To get all this, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/TLC. And don't forget to use the coupon code ELG15, and you'll also get 15% off. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/TLC.
Are you looking to buy or sell a home in the Tampa Bay area without having to deal with pushy realtors? Then make sure you connect with West Florida Real Estate. West Florida Real Estate has helped over 300 homeowners and investors buy and sell their properties over the last 5 years. Their service is outstanding, just like back in the days when there was actually service in the service business, and you'll never have to deal with any kind of sales junk when you're working with them. For more information, email Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com. That's ANNE at westfloridarealestate.com. If you enjoy this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. And today is like one of these days where I'm so grateful that I have this show because I've got Eric Krasno on. And to be honest, I wasn't 100% familiar with a lot of Eric's music. This guy is a beast in every sense of the word. He's incredibly talented. He's just really diverse. And as I told him before we got recording here, I said that I don't ever recall comparing people to like old school Shuggie Otis and Curtis Mayfield. This guy's got such a great vibe and puts out so much good music, like soul, funk, psychedelic. It's just like that really taps into my heart, man. So if you like those styles of music, in addition, he's a jazz player with Soul Live. They're a great band. So if you play guitar or if you like any of these genres of music, pay close attention. quick couple of announcements. I want to first thank our mutual friend Ross James for connecting Eric and I. Sure. Go to everyoneloversguitar.com/subscribe, and you could subscribe to the show on YouTube and the audio. And Carlos Santana, Joe Walsh, I'd love to have those guys on my show. So if you're listening, please connect us. All right, let's talk about Eric Krasno. For nearly two decades, Eric, this guy's like the hardest working man in show. Him and Warren Haynes are the hardest working men in show business. So 2 decades, but like for him, that's probably like 3 or 4 years is like dog years, as much as he plays. For nearly 2 decades, Eric Krasno has been busy playing music as a member of Soul Live. They have 15 studio and live albums since 99, and Lettuce, which Eric was with the band 2002 to 2015, and they have 5 studio and live albums. Both of those bands, he was a co-founder, and he's also played on stage supporting the Rolling Stones, Dave Matthews, John Mayer, and The Roots. He's been behind the scenes as a producer and songwriter for people like Norah Jones, Tedeschi Trucks Band, 50 Cent, Talib Kweli, Aaron Neville, and Alan Stone. His last album under his own name is Blood from a Stone. It is a fucking great record. And in 2019, he released Telescope under Kraz, K-R-A-Z. He's also got projects with Grammatic and Grizz?
Yeah. Grizz. Yeah.
Okay. He's got 2 Grammys, one for Derek and Susan Tedeschi Trucks Band for Revelator, which is a Best Blues Album winner. Eric was a songwriter and guitarist. And for the Derek Trucks Band, Already Free, great record, Best Contemporary Blues Album winner as a guitarist. Dude, thank you so much, man. It's been such a joy.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah,
I really
man.
Appreciate you having me on.
Thank you. Likewise. How'd you first get started in the music business, and what was your first, I don't say big break, because usually it's a series of little breaks, so you take it away, whichever of those makes sense.
Well, that's an interesting one, and just to slightly edit your very gracious introduction there, Lettuce actually started playing together in 1992 when I was 15 years old.
Wow.
I went to a summer program that my dad, hooked me up with the Berklee College of Music 5-week program, and then found out friends, and that's where I met the core band of Lettuce, and we started playing in a room in a basement, and we all decided that a couple of years later for college we were all going to go there, and it actually happened in '94. We all were our freshmen in college, and I started promoting shows for the band. And it started out that we would show up to other people's gigs that we knew at like college frat parties. And we would say, let us play during their set break. That's how we missed that. And, I started out, I had my like crappy station wagon. We'd fill it with gear and we'd like bum rush wherever we could get a gig. And I would make the flyers and I would like ride my bike around Boston and let people know about the band. So, I mean, that was how, if back in those days, we just had to do everything. We booked, we managed, we loaded and all the gear and just, but we just loved it so much. Any time we could play, we did. And then, as time went on, we started to kind of figure out a little bit of the business and how to get gigs. And throughout college, Lettuce would play. And I ended up transferring from Berklee to a place called Hampshire College, which is like a couple hours west in Western Mass. And I would put shows together in at the school there and find whatever gigs I could. In my last year of school, I met up with the Soul Live guys who I'd known previously from their band Moon Boot Lover, who had done shows with Lettuce. And when that band kind of broke up and the Lettuce guys actually all started getting other gigs, our drummer Adam Deitch was playing with Average White Band. And our sax player was in a band called Rustic Overtones that got signed to Arista. So my Lettuce was kind of breaking up, but everyone was kind of doing other different projects. And Soul Live kind of happened in the middle of that. And my last year of college, I linked up with Alan and Neil Evans to form Soul Live. And my like senior recital was actually one of the earliest Soul Live gigs. I mean, actually one of our first gigs was in a dorm on the campus of my school
at Hampshire
and at Hampshire College. Yeah. It was, they called them mods. They were like these school houses and the mod 57 there. You can find that recording actually. It's like, we want to eventually put that out, but it's kind of like a classic Soul Live recording that was recorded in like the living room of that that house. And anyway, so it started from there, and Soul Live just kind of hit the road. You know, Alan and Neil had been touring since they were teenagers, so kind of joining up with them was like they were really like seasoned veterans, you know. And so I was lucky to form with, you know, to get in with them, and they were both like great players and just had a great concept for the band. And I jumped in and just kind of hit the road with them. And within about a year or so, we got a record deal and signed with Blue Note Records. We put out a record ourselves first, and started hitting the club circuit, playing in New York a lot. But I guess, you know, when we signed with Blue Note, it kind of gave us a bit like international, you know, recognition, and the record came out everywhere. And we ended up getting a huge following in Japan, which really blew my mind. Going from playing like dusty clubs in the U.S. to playing like huge theaters and sold out shows and tons of press and radio. And so it happened pretty fast. I think about that now, and I don't know if that could happen now. I mean, it happens in a different way. You know, some people will blow up on YouTube or some, you know, but in that international, like that press that we got and the amount, you know, when you have that big machine behind you, especially as an instrumental band, it was pretty rare to get that. And then from there, you know, at that time I had started producing records, and then all throughout that, you know, while Soul Live was on the road, I would always come home and like build on my studio and work with artists and produce beats for people. And, you know, so there was kind of that sidebar happening while I'd be traveling with Soul Live. And so I guess that's more than just the beginning story, but it's complicated for me. So it wasn't just like one thing happened, and, you know, it's like you said, it's a series of breaks, of little breaks. Yeah.
Well, too, you said it happened fast, but how many gigs had you played? Not just with Soul Live, but Soul Live, and you know, you probably played 400 gigs.
Oh yeah, easily.
So I mean, it's fast for you, but like people don't realize. I think there's this like misconception in any kind of success that they just blew up. Well, you got 400 gigs ahead of you, and you're a kid, and you're booking the shit. It's a little more sweat equity involved in that than it just blew up.
No, this is true. I guess looking back at it now, you know, now I'm 43 years old, and I see it happen. You know, like with Marcus, for example, I mean, he did a ton of gigs, but there was a trajectory that did this, you know, in the last couple of years, and I always knew it was going to happen. There's certain people you see, and you're like, oh, this is going to happen for this person. And you see that, and it's hard for him to know. But you know, when after you've been doing this for 20 something years, you see it, you know. And I think now I can appreciate that a lot more, because I've had so many ups and downs and had to grind, do this and do that. That beginning that happened, and that support that we got after that first album, the first couple albums, was huge. Because I see so many people now trying to get their albums heard, and it's like impossible. There's so much music out there, and the whole streaming thing, it's like impossible. Like an album comes out and then it goes away in like days.
Yeah.
You know, because no one wants to promote, no one wants to invest in artists anymore. You have to invest in yourself now.
Yes.
You know? But when you're 22 years old, you don't really know how to do that. So like the fact that we did have a major label and all these people kind of helping us, you know, I'm appreciative that we had that launch pad.
Yeah.
You know, that's really, really hard to figure out and to navigate now.
Especially on your own at that young age.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, man. You have like an excellent work ethic. And in listening to your story, you had an excellent work ethic when you were 17.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was just so passionate about the music, you know. I wouldn't say I had that work ethic in my social studies class.
You know? but thank God.
Yeah.
You might be a social studies professor instead of making good music.
Yeah, and I'm not knocking that. You know, I was just so into and that never ends. And that's why I love so much being a musician. I can never imagine doing anything else. It's like you get that bug to want to learn something or to want to play something, or you hear someone that inspires you, and there's just nothing that'll stop you at that point. You know what I mean? You just get that bug, and you can't stop, you know? And that, so that, that's really what it is for me, is it's just the passion for music and the passion of, for me too, just being around great musicians, being inspired by other people, being a part of the creative process. That's why I love being in the studio. That's why I love producing. Like, I love being a part of that creation with different people and different bands. And, you know, it's that, that inspires me.
But you still need energy for that, man. You know, where does that come from? Not the physical energy, the drive. Where does that?
Yeah.
Where do you think that comes from?
I think it's the love for the music, you know, and that feeling that you get when you hit that note or you finish that song or you get that mix exactly right. You know, those moments are the best moments, you know?
Right on, man.
So yeah, that's it. You know, always striving for those.
You've played with so many people, so I'm just going to mention a few of them. And if you could tell us a story about maybe how you connected with them or how you got the gig, and then a cool or interesting story about working with them.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Derek and Susan. And also, I don't know if this is accurate. I read that you toured with them on bass, not guitar. You play guitar on the records. Go ahead. Tell the whole story.
Well, that's a really long story. I met Derek when I was like, our first like national tour with Soul Live was, I think, with Derek Trucks Band. We'd only been a band for 5 or 6 months, and we knew him. I think Moon Boot Lover had played a show with them, which was their Neil and Alan Evans. That was their previous band. So they'd known Derek, but as soon as we went on the road with him, you know, he and I were young guys out on the road, and you know, we just clicked. You know, we traveled together. I would ride on his RV at the time, and we just became really close. And then he got the Allman Brothers gig that year, and I lived in New York City. So as soon as he got to New York, he called me up, and we were kind of like, you know, thick as thieves. We would go out and go record shopping, you know, for him, that was early on too. So he would get this per diem, and he'd call me, I got the per diem. Let's go to, you know, Virgin Records, you know, back when there was record stores.
Yeah. I remember records. I'm from New York, bro.
We would come out with stacks of records and go to my house and listen to them, you know, and I'd show him like jazz records. I studied with a guy named Yusef Lateef when I was in college. So Yusef had, I was like finding Yusef records and getting hit. I would come up with the jazz stuff, and he would show me like old blues stuff and a lot of Indian music, and we just connected, man. And he loved Soul Live. I remember that. I think it was that year he and O'Teal, who we were all close, would quote Soul Live songs during their Allman Brothers shows, like in the jam sessions.
Yeah.
And they ended up putting out one of those albums. I forget. It's from the early, maybe 2000, around then. We got a call that our publishing company was being used on an Allman Brothers record. We were like, what? And it turned out they were quoting so much Soul Live in this that they ended up being like, hey, you guys got to give publishing to Soul Live for some of those jams.
Oh my
God. So we
had
publishing on some of those Allman Brothers live albums.
That's funny.
But yeah, so we would just hang, you know, and then as time went on, when he was, you know, fast forward way later, when he was doing Tedeschi Trucks Band, he brought me into the studio to kind of vibe out, you know, he's trying to figure out the sound, and he knew that I was a producer and a writer, and you know, I was always sharing music with him I was working on. So I think the first session we did was myself, Adam Deitch, O'Teal, and him down in the studio, and we wrote a bunch of songs and a bunch of grooves, and from there, you know, the rest of the evolution. I mean, every time he'd make a record, you know, he started piecing the band together. He'd bring me in to come jam with them. And I've written on most of the albums, you know,
right.
Some have been involved. And in certain cases, on the second album, Made Up Mind, O'Teal had left the band, and we were writing. I wrote like 5 songs on that record. So when I was down there, I would play bass on the sessions, you know, because originally we would demo. Because I was a bass player first, just to rewind.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, I was a bass player when I was like 13, and then I switched to guitar. Because my brother's a guitar player, and my dad plays piano and mandolin and stuff. So it was made sense for me to put bass. No, my brother did for a while, and my grandfather was a professional musician, played piano, and he played like gypsy music,
and
jazz, classical, played a violin.
Okay.
His main instrument, he played piano too. So anyway, it made sense for me to play bass as a kid. And then as time went on, I just gravitated towards guitar, and I would always like borrow my brother's guitar until eventually I got one for myself, got one of my own. And then it just kind of took off from there. But anyway, so going back to, I was playing bass in the studio on a lot of the sessions, and, Soul Live was kind of winding down the touring, and they were like, "Hey, do you want to come out on this run and play bass, you know, see how it goes?" And they were in between, you know, Oteil was on the band and they needed somebody to fill in like kind of soon. And they tried out a couple of people, but they were like, you know, we were just all so close as friends, and I knew everyone in the band really well.
Yeah.
So it just made sense.
Yeah.
You know, totally. So I went out on the road with them for maybe 4 or 5 months. And then, I can't remember. I don't know if I actually recommended. I know that they met Tim LaFave, and I knew him and I was friends with him, and I was like, "Man, you guys, if it fits, you guys should do that," because I had so many other things going on. I had a solo record, Blood from a Stone, that I was finishing, and Soul Live wanted to do some more touring, and then I was still playing with Lettuce on and off. So then I left and on like completely amicable terms, but it was a really fun time. And that the main tour that we did was this summer tour with the Black Crowes and the London Souls, which was the band I was producing at the time. So it was a big old family.
It was family, man. Yeah. Did you play? I saw them down here in Vinoy at the Blues Festival here in it was in St. Pete. I'm going to say like 5 years ago. Were you in the band then?
Maybe. I can't remember. Oh, was it the Sunshine Blues Festival?
Yeah, it was down in, there was one in Boca, and I live in Tampa, so we went to St. Pete.
Yeah. I'd done those before, but I don't know which year or whatever. Yeah. I definitely played that festival before.
I tell you, I took my son there, and I've seen hundreds and hundreds of shows. Derek closed the night with, I think it's Down in the Flood, a Bob Dylan song.
Yeah.
I have, I've seen plenty of great guitar shit. I couldn't speak after that. What he did, I've never saw.
I think he's the greatest current guitar player, in my opinion. I think.
I've just never. Dude, I was like, oh my God. And my son's like, "Dad, what's the matter?" I'm like, "You're never going to see this again. What just happened here?" You know, it was just like literally transcendent. I was like, no drugs or nothing. You know, it was just like, wow. I'd never seen or experienced anything like that, man. It's just amazing.
I mean, I think what he does, no one will ever do what he does like he does. I mean, he's, as far as like slide guitar and just his playing in general, it's flawless. So much emotion. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it really is. Questlove.
I'm trying to think of how I met him originally. That goes way back too. How did I meet him? I think the first time I met him actually was a gig. We had this band called The Concept was the name of it. And the first time we ever did it, I don't think we had the name the very first time, but then we came up with it, was a promoter. I think this is the first time I met him was my friend Paul Peck put this show together in New Orleans. And it was George Porter from The Meters on bass, myself, Questlove on drums, Bill Summers from the Headhunters, Herbie Hancock from the Headhunters. And I believe it was Tim Green. I think Ivan Neville on keys.
And
so it was
band.
Like a super group. Yeah. And then we met there and we just clicked, you know, and then I did various gigs with the Roots where they were like figuring out the guitar thing. And when they did I'd played with them. We did the 4th of July show where they needed two guitars, and we like backed up some of the Earth, Wind & Fire guys, and we did stuff with Michael McDonald. And every once in a while when they needed another guitar, I would hop in. I did a recording sessions with them, and we did the Betty Wright album, which was when they backed her for her soul album. So we just became friends, and like he would always send me like Soul Train videos and he's always like, you know, he's like, man, that dude is an encyclopedia. What an incredible mind, you know, that he's just amazing. And obviously incredible band leader and musician. And, you know, whenever he calls me, I jump at the chance to work with him and his crew. You know, they're just probably, you know, one of the best bands of our time.
Yeah. You know? Man, you've worked with some tight drummers.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm lucky in that department.
Oh my, yeah, because I was listening to your drummer's Adam, right? Deitch.
Yeah, well, he's in Lettuce, yeah, and then he plays on some of my own stuff as well.
That guy's banging, man.
Yeah, he's great. He's great.
Robert Randolph, I saw him in concert as well. How'd you guys hook up?
Yeah. We met at one of his first gigs. He opened for Derek Chuck's band at the Bowery Ballroom, maybe like 2000.
Wow.
And he was like, man, he was like a straight out of the church. I don't think he'd even played a gig outside of church. He had like, I always think about it because he had like, you know, the pleated like church pants and the shirt buttoned up. And like, I was with him 2 days ago, but he's someone that I've just been friends with forever. I've been on and written on like most of his albums. And we just clicked, man. He's one of those guys, and he's got that same thing where he just channels, you know, the way Derek does. He's just, you know, that there's an inexplicable thing with him where he doesn't necessarily know every note and every scale that he's using. He just channels, you know, and he sings through his instrument. And that's what I gravitate toward, man. It's like, I love guys who sing with their instrument, and they channel that it's that thing that you can't really learn it. You know, it's one of those things that's just there, you know.
How long have you been writing? Because I'm really amazed, not just how prolific you are, but how prolific you are in so many different ranges. You know, that you're like the Brill Building guys, you know. You don't usually, that's not just a common thing where some, you know, usually people write what they write. You're really, yeah, like, how long have you been writing? Were you always writing?
You know, I guess so. You know, I was always in original bands. I was always inspired by that. I remember listening to Led Zeppelin records. That was like when I first started playing guitar, I kind of learned from those records.
Sure.
And thinking, I remember like Jimmy Page, or I was like, how did he come up with that? Or, you know, and even like Stone, my dad was a big Rolling Stones fan. I don't know. I was fascinated at the process. I think it goes back to the first thing I said, that process of coming up with the songs. And that was why I was so fascinated with being a producer, because I would study my dad's record collection. I'd sit down there and look at him, and I'd play him, and I'd look at the liner notes and want to know everything. I was like, what does that guy do? Like, who, what does the engineer do? What does the producer do? What are the right, how do they write these songs? That's just, I've just been like so fascinated with that my entire life, since a teenager. And you know, I don't know. I whenever people are in the studio, I'm all, you know, and I don't, and I'm also just like I'm a really social guy. I love, you know, when I'm out at festivals and I'm out on tour, like, you know, I have a lot of friends out there, and I have a lot of musician friends. So we, you know, when they're in town, they call me, we get together, we write. It's just a thing that kind of started happening at some point. And the Soul Live guys are such great writers, you know, and they inspired me too. And the Lettuce guys, Adam Deitch, great songwriter. I've always been inspired by the people I've been around and been in bands with, and I'm fortunate. You know, Neil Evans from Soul Live is one of the greatest writers ever. And he challenged me a lot in the beginning, because I would come up with cool grooves and cool melodies, but he has just such a unique writing ability, and it's just such an incredible angle and way to make things really weird, but make the melody kind of like loop everything together. Anyway, so I think it was some of the people around me that inspired me to get better. And I just been kind of like chasing it ever since, you know?
Yeah, man, we'll keep chasing it, because it's really wonderful to listen to stuff you put together, man.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that.
I listen to some of the Soul Live stuff even, and it's just the riffs you're doing on there. That's not easy music. And
yeah,
it's pretty amazing. Some of the, you know, you're pulling off really long, really melodic riffs to fit in those complex chord changes. It's really impressive, man. It just sounds, it's just great. Keep doing whatever the hell you're doing, man. Whatever the formula, whatever you're eating, whatever your training regimen is, keep it up, brother, because it's working.
Thank you.
And then talk about Marcus. How did you guys connect? You mentioned him a couple of times.
Marcus actually was through Warren Haynes, and his, like, Warren's kind of team. because I was managed by his team for a long time there, who also managed Marcus for a while. So yeah, they sent me his music. He had reached out through them, I guess, because he was a fan and like wanted to link up. And once I heard him, I was like, no doubt. And he was maybe 17 at the time or 18. And man, we hit it off. Like, he came over and I remember we hung out all night till like 5. It was until 4 in the morning or something, just listening to music. We were like brothers like that, you know. He's just that type of guy. I just, you know, have so much love for him. And I've worked with him on a ton of stuff, you know. I've produced for him and written with him. We toured together, you know, when my solo band kind of first kicked in after Blood from a Stone, we did a co-bill tour like all over the country. And you know, he's just one of those guys. He calls me, you know, at least once a week or a couple times a week. How to navigate the business and how to kind of, you know, make different decisions that pop up as your career is building and stuff. And he's someone who works so hard at his craft, but also has like all that natural ability combined. He's going to be a huge star.
That's awesome. You know?
He's got the right head on his shoulders. He's a smart dude. He takes care of the people around him. You know, he's got a great family. His dad is one of the sweetest guys in the world, Marvin. And he's just one of those dudes that doesn't come around that often, you know, to have like that humility, but also that talent and that drive all combined into one guy, and the ability to like lead a band and not get too messed up on the road. You know, a lot of guys that talent will fall into, you know, stuff and get messed up. He's just got it all.
That's great, man. Most of the, I would say today, my experience anyway, from the people I've spoken to, people are pretty smart. You can't afford to be screwing around and getting messed up on the road now. I don't just mean you can't afford to do the drugs, which you probably can't because you're not gonna have money left over anything else, but you gotta be on top of your own shit nowadays, man.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. You know, it used to be that, you know, the labels and the management and all that would kind of take care of artists on every level. But it's hard because the labels aren't making as much as they were before. So they won't invest and like completely take care of everything. They will work with you to build your career, but you really have to take charge of it yourself these days.
Yeah. It's like your health, man. You people sit around waiting to go to the doctor and let the doctor fix it, man. You got to go to the gym or do something. Yeah. Watch what you're eating.
Yeah.
Blood from a Stone, you mentioned it. It's literally one of the best blues funk records I've heard in ages. I loved it. Like I said, really funky blues, reminded me of Shuggy Otis's first album from 1969. So I know this is not a very specific question, but just tell me about like the vibe you wanted for that record or what was going on in your life at that time, because that was deep, man. That was
Really, I mean, it's definitely like it's a breakup record, and it was definitely in a time where I was going through a lot. And my co-writer, I have to give him a lot of credit, Dave Gutter, who wrote a lot of the words on the record with me. Initially, I called Dave and I was like, you know, I'm trying to make a solo album. I've been writing these songs and I've got these ideas, but he's the lead singer of a group called the Rustic Overtones, who I'd known for at least 20 years now. And they had a big record deal in the 90s and had a huge following. And I played on some of their records and I always was just such a fan of his writing. So I called him and I said, I'm working on a record. And we decided that I'd go up to Maine where he lives. And Ryan Zoidis, the sax player from Lettuce, who used to be in Rustic Overtone Sioux, they have a studio there. I mean, it's basically like a garage with a bunch of gear in it. And I originally was going up there to kind of just demo some stuff. And they had an old 8-track tape machine and a dusty console. And we went in that room and started busting out these riffs, and he'd be writing in the corner and then I'd be writing and then I'd be coming up with the riffs and da-da-da-da. And we pretty much did the whole record in like a week in that little barn, in that little garage. And we thought it was going to be demos, but when we hit the playback, I was like, man, this is great. And it's kind of got this dusty, dirty, vibe to it. And that the drummer from the London Souls, Chris, came up and played on a lot of it. And Stu Mahan, see, the rhythm section for the London Souls, were kind of happened to be in town, you know, and I was like, well, come on. And then I was like, listen, you guys got to stick around. And we pretty much did it all right there. And Ryan Zoidis and John Roods, the two guys, both from Rustic Overtones, were in there tweaking knobs. And, you know, we went and borrowed stuff around town. Once we realized we were making a record, we went to all their friends. Hey, we need to borrow this mic. We need to borrow this amp, this guitar. And I brought a bunch of my gear up there in my old truck or whatever. And
you were living in New York at the time.
I was living in New York, but okay. I wanted to get out of the city to write this record. Had a bunch of ideas. And then I basically took those tapes. We transferred things to Pro Tools. I went back to New York and fleshed it all out. And it took a while for it to come out because I was also like signing a new record deal. And I ended up working with a guy named Russ Elevato, who'd worked on the D'Angelo records and just a really great engineer. He ended up doing the new Lettuce record too. And
he engineered your solo record.
Yeah, he basically mixed it. Co-mixed him and then another guy, John Davis at the Bunker. So we went through some different mix stages because I added a lot of elements to it. And then there's a track called On the Rise that's on that record, which was the last song that I did. And that was the song where I actually worked with Jeremy Most, who ended up producing my newest album. So that that song was kind of like the pivot into the sound that became the Kraz album. So anyway, I was just kind of going through Dave and I were both going through breakups with long-term girlfriends. So we were right on the same page with writing this stuff, you know, like Torture and all these songs. Like Torture, he came up with that one. And I was like, I hear you, man. And we just started, that one came out like that. And Plesia was one of the first ones we did, and Jezebel. And it just, you know, it's just he and I just clicked. And we've been writing together. And then subsequently, the songs on Made Up Mind, the Teskey Trucks band, we wrote a bunch of those together as well, Dave and I. So Dave's just one of those guys that when you get in a room with him, he just starts going. He'll write and he'll just throw a million ideas at me. And I'll be like, that one. And he'll just keep going. And then we just have this like frantic energy where we won't sleep until we've written like 10 songs, you know? So I love
that's work ethic too, though, man. I know you're passionate about it, but that's a component that is to me the most important thing of anybody being successful in any business. But you can't make that. You either have that or you don't.
Right.
You know,
right.
You could be really passionate, but be fucking lazy.
And exactly. And another interesting thing that whenever I'm talking to like young writers and young artists, is that you got to write, like a lot of people say, oh, I'm not a great writer. Write 500 songs.
Yeah.
You
know, right.
Like, that's the whole thing is people think, oh, how did you write those 10 songs? No. I wrote 100 songs. You heard 10.
Right. Right.
You know, we're in here stacking songs.
Right.
And then when we get one of those that's good, we go in on it. Like we have thousands. When you're a songwriter, that's really passionate, you're writing hundreds of songs before, you know. And then as you get better, the ratio gets better.
Yeah, instead of one in 15 and one in 10 and one in 9.
You get better, but it's not just something that, oh, like you snap your feet, like you just are a songwriter. No, you work on it just like you practice scales and just like you practice anything else. So it's one of those things where it's not like, you know, and I've started getting on that later. You know, I was, you know, I wish I had started writing. I mean, as far as lyrics, you know, I was writing music at a young age, but I didn't start writing lyrics till later. And that's, I mean, to me, that's the hardest part for me.
Right. Is the lyrics.
Yeah. And that's gotten easier. Well, it's also, I think I have a high standard for it too. Like a lot of new music, I get frustrated because I don't love the lyrical content.
I didn't know that. I didn't realize it had lyrical content.
Right, exactly.
Is there lyrics?
So, it's funny because I'm a musician, I'm a guitarist, but if the lyric isn't great, I can't do it. You know?
Yeah.
So I'm really picky with that and with what I listen to at least. So anyway, I don't even remember where I was going. Yeah. So Blood from a Stone, it was a process. I also initially went in thinking other people were going to sing those songs. And then once we got through the demos, I was like, you know what? And it was really the other guys, Ryan and Dave and John, who were in the studio. They were like, no, these are your songs. You're singing these songs. And so in the end, that is what happened. I didn't really see myself as a singer. I always would sing my demos to people when I would write for other people. And so I kind of got a little bit better at it just from doing that. But then after Blood from a Stone and I had to tour it, then that was like a whole, that was really nerve wracking and just like.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, was it weird the first time you had to sing a whole show?
Oh my God. I still am so nervous about singing.
I'm sure.
You know, it's not my strong suit, you know, but I've kind of like started to figure out where my range is and like what works for me. And, you know, by no means am I like a singer.
Your voice was great on those songs. Everyone,
I appreciate it. I mean, I really know how to.
I was shocked because I was like, wow, this guy sings too. It fits everything there, man. It was perfect.
I appreciate that. It's definitely my most nerve wracking thing. You know, I don't get nervous playing at all, but I'm getting more confident with singing, but it's, I'm good at singing my songs, you know, and then I started playing with Phil Lesh and in the Dead stuff.
Yeah.
He's got me singing a lot in that band. And those first few gigs of like singing Dead songs in front of 5,000 Deadheads that know every word.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was nerve wracking. Now that's getting easy. That's getting easier too. And that was such good training ground for me playing with him and learning all that music, man. There's just so many songs. It made a big difference in my confidence for sure too.
Well, too, you're probably hard on yourself with singing because in your mind, your frame of reference as a performer is guitar.
Right.
Which you've put hundreds of thousands of hours into. So probably part of you is like saying, well, how can I be good at this when I've only done it for maybe 5% of the time? That's kind of like a normal thing, I would, you know, if your frame of, yeah.
Also being, you know, in bands with Nigel Hall and Susan Tedeschi and working with Chaka Khan. I mean, I've worked with like the greatest singers of all time, you know, in my opinion, of our era.
Yeah, sure.
And I'm sitting there like, which is why, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Nigel, but, you know, I produced his first album and I wrote a lot of the songs on that record. And a lot of those, you know, that experience of like writing a song. And same with Susan, and you do this demo with like just this basic vocal, and then you hear it come out of them, and you're just like, oh my God. You know? So like,
that's cool.
That experience is like kind of, you know, definitely was like, you know, I don't know. Still when I sing my songs, I still imagine other people singing them sometimes, you know? Yeah. And then I got to do a whole album of Aaron Neville, which was exactly that process where I demoed all the songs me singing and then having him come in and sing it.
That's cool.
You know, it was the craziest experience of my life, probably, you know, having this voice that I grew up on, you know, and with him, he actually sent me 50 poems and said, you know, make music with this.
Wow.
And Dave Gutter and I went up to my mom's house up in Vermont, went to the woods and just wrote songs. And a lot of it, we would just took excerpts from the poems and then wrote songs to that. And then in certain cases would take like huge pieces of the poems. And we wrote all the music to that. And then I demoed them, you know, on a crappy mic, me singing it. And then we went to the studio with him and he heard it all. And then we would find the right key for his range. And then he would make me sing it again in front of him, like doing to show he'd have a guide track, you know? So, and we'd start at like 7:30 in the morning because that was his thing. He'd like go work out, like, and then he'd wake, meet us like 8 in the morning. And so I'm like drinking my coffee. And then our Aaron's like, okay, Kraz, go in there. And I would have to sing like Aaron Neville in his key in front of him. Like in the booth, it was like the, you know, talk about another nerve wracking situation. But then he would go in there and sing it, you know, and it was just like angels from above descending, you know, and that was a really amazing experience to get to do that too.
Well, but, man, I love your voice. I thought it was great on both Kraz and Eric Krasno record. Let's talk about Telescope. Okay. So like, I thought it was weird. It had like a, like an alt, a pop, contemporary soul vibe on side one. And then side two was like soulful, pretty ballads. It was really funk and soul, but slowed down a bit. And there's some dark songs on there. You know,
it's a dark album. And I don't know if you saw any of the videos surrounding it, but
I didn't.
Okay. So the idea of the album is, and I'm actually glad that because I've been wanting people to listen to it kind of, I'm curious how people perceive it without knowing the story. Cause the telescope is a concept album about a building. It's essentially about the building I lived in Brooklyn. And it's about the characters that lived in this building. And if you watch the videos, that becomes apparent because it's basically this voyeur kind of like watching this building. And then, you know, the idea came about when I was like starting to write a record after Blood from a Stone. I didn't want to write something from like the first person perspective. I've always loved writing from other people's perspectives. Like if I'm writing for a woman or another artist and I'm putting myself in their head. So I was like, well, what if I kind of created this world where I'm writing from the perspective of these different people that, and then essentially I was like, well, I live in this building and I've watched these people live here. I've been here for 15 years and like I've seen their children grow up and I've seen these different people move in and out. And watch these different like people, you know, families like get married, have a kid, then break up. So I decided to write this record kind of from the perspective of like this building and the people that interact in this building. So each song flows into the next one as part of this storyline. So if you look at, if you actually go to like, I think it's KrasTelescope or maybe KrasMusic.com, you'll see all the videos and the characters in there. And it basically follows a story about the people living in this building and like the gentrification of this neighborhood. But the songs totally live on their own. So, you know, you don't have to know that
right.
to enjoy the album.
I loved it.
Yeah.
Like I was going to ask you, a lot of the songs on side two were like almost an homage to, you know, giving up partying. So I was going to ask you, I think the answer is no. Like, are you a guy who's gotten sober and that was this like your.
No, that's about a character in there. Oh. I mean, it's about a group of characters.
Okay.
But, you know, I mean, I think some of my stuff is in there, you know, each song I wrote, you know, some of them were songs I'd written a chorus to years ago. And as I was putting the storyline together, I was like, oh man, that song totally works with the concept of the album because I can flip it and make it the verses about this. And the first song Leave a Little is about the character Gina, who's like this girl from the Midwest. Who's like a homecoming queen. She moves to New York and to be a actor and a model and gets sucked into the nightlife, becomes a bartender. And Leave a Little is like her party. It's like her party theme. And like, kind of like her conscious saying like, leave a little. And then the next song is Recovery, which is like, after she's had this long night of partying, she realizes she needs to get herself together. And in that process, she meets the guy who lives upstairs from her, who is like the husband in this relationship that's kind of falling apart. Then they kind of, he becomes like a father figure to her. It's one of, if you look at the videos, it shows this story as the songs kind of happen. So it's a really weird, you know, I was like one of those kids too, that was just loved concept albums, you know, and I always wanted to create something like that. It's a little abstract and it's a lot to ask of like the current audience these days because, you know, they're very much
to think and read and watch. I don't know, Eric, it's like two tasks too many for the,
So
pick a task, listen, read or watch.
Exactly. But for those who want to go, that have the time to go to dig deep, there's a lot to the album. You know?
That last track on there.
Yeah.
It's All at Once. I honestly, man, I'm just getting goosebumps now. I listened to that like 3 or 4 times. I was like frozen. That is so moving. What is the backstory to that, man?
So that's that one about the couple breaking up that have a child, basically. And the guy and the girl, the guy's a musician, the girl's a an artist, and she ends up having to get a job in graphic design. And his career, basically, they start out as this beautiful couple that's like so in love, and they're artists and they have these artistic visions. And then when they decide to start a family, they both have to kind of, you know, give up their art to a certain degree. And then they basically start to resent each other because of that. And it's kind of about this beautiful relationship falling apart because there's too many things all at once, you know, like she's trying to take care of the child, trying to pay the bills. He's trying to be a musician, but he's also got to be the stay at home dad. And, so yeah, it's a sad one.
But, very deep though, man. Really moving. Yeah. Honestly, man, what a beautiful. I literally listened to it 3 or 4 times. It was just, and I couldn't do anything else while I was doing it.
You saying that. Yeah, and that's like the last song of the album, which kind of like, so it's like great. I think it's just, and I think that one, it's just me playing acoustic and I think it's just me. Oh, my friend Sonia sings on it, but I'm just playing piano and guitar and vocal, and just decided to do that one just totally stripped down.
Great song to close the record out with, man. Really, really fantastic. How come some of the stuff you issue is under Kraz and some of it's Eric Krasno?
With that album, I just wanted, because it was this concept and the sound was pretty different, you know, I just felt like doing it under a different moniker.
Yeah.
I don't know that there was much sense to it. Besides that, I just felt like it was such a departure from everything else that I thought it just needed a different name.
Sure.
Yeah.
Bowl Live at Brooklyn Bowl. That is a really cool annual event. I was curious what prompted you to put that together. Tell people what it is, what prompted you to put it together, and talk about maybe what you've learned since the first show in 2010. Like, have things changed? Yeah. Have things evolved?
Yeah, so Pete Shapiro is a good friend of mine. He was opening. He's the owner of the Brooklyn Bowl. He also owns Relics magazine, and you know he's like a.
Oh yeah, right. I knew that name.
Together. Yeah, he also has Lock-In Festival is his thing.
Yep.
So anyway, he and I have been good friends. He used to own the Wetlands, which is where we did some of our first gigs back in the early days in New York. And when he was opening Brooklyn Bowl, I ran into him actually at the Allman Brothers Beacon Theater, they always had that legendary Beacon Theater run.
The run in October.
He's like, I'm building a bowling alley. It's going to be a music venue. I want Soul Live to do a month or whatever. And I was like, okay, man. You know, and I was kind of like trying to have a bowling alley. And then he showed me it a couple weeks later when it was being put together. And I was like, wow, okay. And then my brother, who was managing us at the time, I think he came up with the actual name Bowl Live.
Yeah, it was cool. Like Bowl Live, Soul Live. Yeah, it made sense.
Brother's really good at that. He's good at naming things. But also, you know, the idea of us being – we've always had that. I mean, in our years past, we would have different singers, different horn players. And, you know, we're a trio, and so we're very easily – we can always add, you know, to that. So the idea was just to have different guests every night. And we also have so many friends in the biz, you know, and so it just made perfect sense for us to do this. And it evolved over time, but I mean, the concept stayed the same. It was, you know, we're the band, we bring in all sorts of artists. We've had everybody from like Questlove, Derek Trucks, Warren Haynes, John Schofield is kind of a regular, George Porter from the Meters is a regular. We've had a lot of rappers, DMC from Run DMC. I mean, it's all over the map. We pretty much do any style. I mean, as long as there's soulful, you know, it's anything soulful, we do. And, it's kind of just become this event, this big event in New York City that people look forward to. And, you know, we look forward to it, and it's always fun having different collaborators every year.
Very cool. Has anything changed as far as like any lessons learned from doing all these?
Yeah, I mean, one of them is just to be kind of ready for anything, you know, and not, you know, we rehearse and we practice, but I think we've just gotten better at doing it. You know what I mean? It's not, sure. You have to be prepped. It's, you know, cause I also do a lot of, musical director gigs where I help put big events together, where you're having different artists and different band members. And I think with Bowl Live, the way, you know, and with that, you have to do so much homework, and it's all about getting the band prepared and getting the music right, and communication with the artist. And with Bowl Live, there's the same, we're doing that same thing, but I think what people love about it is the spontaneity.
Yeah.
So we have to leave room for that. And I think in the beginning, you know, maybe we spent too much time working out the details when, you know, when we realize over time, it's more about being ready for whatever's going to happen in that moment. You know what I mean? Because always the best moments were the unplanned ones.
Yeah.
Where, oh, this guy's in town, and oh, he's going to bring this guy. Like, Kamasi Washington's down the street. He wants to sit in. Cool. Let's do Footprints, but then let's do this version. And with that. So like the fact is, like, over the years, we've just, our repertoire has become so massive.
Yeah.
From working with all these different people. And you know, sometimes we might just come up with a groove and just hit it. Like George Porter, will all come in and just be like, okay guys, I got a groove, here it is. And it won't be on the set list. You know, maybe in the year one, that might've stressed people out. Now we're all for it. You know what I mean? We're
right.
Like, let's go. So I think that's what's changed, is we're not afraid to crash and burn, you know?
Good.
And that's something I've learned from like the Grateful Dead, working with Phil Lesh and stuff too. Is like, Phil would rather change the set every night and like take those chances and, you know, go for the, you know, go for the home run, even if there's a swing and a miss, you know, a couple times a night.
Sure, sure.
Which I respect, you know, and I think one of the things we've learned from it too is like, we will change our set list every single night and not repeat songs because we want to give a fresh show every night. And that isn't the most comfortable thing to do, but the audience for Bowl Live, if we like mess up something or something isn't exactly right, they kind of like that. You know what I mean? They like to see us take the chances.
Yeah.
You know, this is not a pop concert where every show is exactly the same and you're looking for these exact cues. It's about giving people an experience that they're not going to experience again.
Anywhere in the next Tuesday to Wednesday or Saturday to Sunday or Friday to Saturday, man. That's
exactly.
Tell people when Bowl Live is if they want to pay attention.
You know, this, we've changed it a few times. It used to be every year in March. This last year we did July. So I think we're doing July again this year, but it has not been scheduled.
And where's the info? Is it on bowlive.com or is it on erickrasno.com?
Yeah, if you go to, I think soullive.com, or, great, you know, if you go to erickrasno.com, it'll definitely be there too. But soullive.com should have all of it.
Great. And let me just spell it. It's soullive, SOULIVE. Exactly. And Eric Krasno, it's Eric, ERIC, Krasno with a K, KRASNO. Yeah. Tell me, knee-jerk reaction, top three musical experiences you've had.
Whew.
Tough question, I know. Really.
Well,
tough.
One was definitely when Stevie Wonder jumped on stage with Soul Live at the LA House of Blues one night. And that was massive for me. And watching the crowd just go completely nuts. We were going nuts. And he stayed up there for like 40 minutes or something.
Wow.
Played harmonica, sang a bunch of tunes. It was just like maybe the craziest moment ever. You know, I'd say it was a lot of the different collaborations that have happened. It's hard to narrow it down to three, though.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, definitely opening for the Rolling Stones. The first night opening for the Rolling Stones in Philly at the Tower Theater, which is a tiny place for them. That was a crazy, huge moment for me. And hanging out with those guys.
Were they, and I'm not looking for any kind of gossip, were they like laid back?
Oh yeah,
they were. So yeah, they were just like regular, like no different than you and I have in this conversation.
No,
yeah, Keith, that's really cool.
Especially so cool. They were all great, and they were all very gracious to us. They found us because, well, Charlie Watts was a fan and had our first album, and he.
Dude, how cool is that? Just hearing that out of your mouth. That's gotta be like
the fact that he told them, and then Mick came to our show in Toronto without us even seeing him or knowing, and then the next day we got the call.
Wow.
But
hey man,
yeah,
fucking, I mean, congratulations. Well deserved, man.
Thank you.
That's awesome.
I mean, that was 2002, a long time ago. But the fact that they would have an instrumental, like, jazz, funk, whatever, soul group open for, I mean, I don't know of any other band that's ever done that. You know, the other bands on that tour were like No Doubt, you know, and, you know, so
yeah,
it was like, yeah, you know, the fact that they put us on, you know, and they, we did a bunch of shows, was pretty huge, that they would do that. And it was a pretty cool experience.
That is
especially
cool.
My parents were the biggest Stones fan ever. You know, those are the records that I would listen to growing up. So that was a big one.
Did they come to the show? Did your folks get to come to the show?
Yeah. Yeah. That show was actually that Philly show.
Philly?
Part of what made that show so amazing. My parents got divorced when I was really young and they didn't communicate at all. And then the first time they saw each, I mean, they both had been remarried, you know, many years at that point. The first time they actually saw each other again was at that show. And I didn't even really like think it all through. I was a little worried that they were going to be there and they might see each other. But then, of course, after our set, my tour manager comes back and I was like, hey, I want to go see my folks. Like, where are they sitting? And of course, there are four of them are sitting right next to each other. And I'm like, oh, man. And I go out there nervous that there's something's gone down. One of them's left. Of course, I get there and they're all dancing and singing along and high fiving. So I told Keith that story and it was pretty, you know, crazy moment that their music, you know, brought that together. And honestly, they've been, you know, my whole family's been kind of cool ever since. I mean, they don't hang out all the time, but the communication has been way, you know, it's a different thing since then. So,
man, you know, it's interesting. First of all, I'm really happy. Thanks for sharing that. I'm glad that yeah. I've had a feel good for you or like some closure, I would imagine in
for
some
sure,
way.
For sure.
When you were talking about this, I was going to ask you, is that somewhat autobiographical when you were talking about that song All at Once about the couple break? Something in my mind was like, man, I think there's something here because that song is too intense for that to have been a, well, I was imagining that was too deep to be like, well, I thought it would work. Like, you know, I was that was good, man.
Well, it was a combination of me and then, a family that I know. So it was like some of the, I mean, and it wasn't, it's fictional, the actual situation as far as the couple and the kids, but it's definitely related to a relationship that went south for me, but there was no kid. I've met no kids. So, but then I kind of infused that with the situation with a couple that I knew that did have a kid. And one of them's a musician, one of them's an artist, and like how they stayed together actually. So that was more like the situation of them juggling that with the kid. And then the other part of it falling apart was more, that was the more autobiographical part, but it was a fictional story, but it came from a real place.
Yeah. The feelings in there had to be,
the album is like that. I mean, all of it is from me, but I kind of put it in these situations of other people. You know?
Awesome. Number three, Stevie Wonder, Rolling Stones, Philadelphia. Number three.
Okay. Now this one's going to be tough. What is this? What's the next one?
Just go with your gut.
Wow. There's so many that are scrolling. I'm scrolling through.
swipe left. Yeah,
I'm going through, scrolling through my iPhone and my brain. You know, I don't even know which show that I'm going to say, but John Scofield was my hero as a child, and playing with him and kind of becoming very close with him, and he's become sort of a mentor.
That's
and the
great.
first time he played with Soul Eye was like in, I think, the summer of 99 or 2000. And just him embracing us was so huge. First, him just playing on stage for me the first time just kind of blew my mind. And then him playing on our album subsequently. And then, you know, I talk to him regularly. He's like an uncle, you know? So for him, you know, that's to him.
That's
and
cool.
I always tell him, I always go back to the fact that, you know, I was his biggest fan ever. So that was more of like a relationship that formed, but that first show that he played with us, because that was also the first time Soul Live had like one of our heroes on stage with us, right?
Sure.
Like we were freaking out, you know? And of course, he's not a household name amongst everyone, but for a guitarist and for a musician, especially me in particular, that was really huge for me.
So. Give me one more, man, because you got so many.
One more? Well, so I guess this is a tough one because they kind of I'm a part of a concert called the Love Rocks concert. Mm-hmm. And this is something you guys can look up, Love Rocks NYC. And, you know, every year we have huge artists on stage with us. And, you know, there's been so many amazing collaborations. But this last year we had Robert Plant. And I got to do the Zeppelin stuff with Robert Plant.
Holy shit.
Which goes back to the first thing I probably said, whatever, it was 45 minutes ago when that was the first stuff I learned. And so getting to work with him, and he actually had like kind of came to me to help kind of arrange one of the songs, you know, with like this 22 piece band. We've got Steve Gadd on drums, Will Lee on bass, Paul Schaefer on keys.
All these New York cats.
Yeah, like the super band. So I want to shout out to Will Lee and Greg Williamson and John Barbados, who kind of ushered me into that gig, which has just been so big for me, every year. I mean, we've had Norah Jones, we've had Keith Richards, we've had Aaron Neville, Michael McDonald, Gary Clark, all over the map. Just so many great musicians have done that gig. So Love Rocks is a huge one, but specifically the Robert Plant collaboration this past year was a big one.
That's awesome. You're in like all these projects that you're in. I would imagine some of them you started.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah. Lettuce and Soul Live for sure. And then, you know, I have a million other kind of offshoots. I have a project called Dr. Claw, which is with Ian Neville and Nigel Hall and Nick Daniels, who's to me is like an unsung hero of bass and vocals. And they're from the group Dumpster Funk. So that's one that we do at Jazz Fest in New Orleans is kind of like where we do a lot of those projects every year. Mm. I have a project with Marcus King called The Cleaners with Dwayne Trucks, who's Derek's little brother.
Right. The Cleaners. that's a cool name, man. Yeah.
So like that's a fun one with Marcus. You know, we're always kind of coming up with, you know, that's the cool thing about the scene that surrounds Lettuce and Soul Live and a lot of these bands is like, they just love when we come up with these different, you know, weird projects. And then for my own thing, I've been doing this thing called E3, which is an organ trio Eric. Yeah. And it's all Eric Kalb and Eric Finland, who, and are really just great New York players, drums and organ. So I've got there's a lot going on.
Yeah, man. But you know what? I asked you that because a lot of musicians out there, I think are, you know, they say, how does this guy get involved in so much? Because you get involved, you do it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like you're sitting around you live in LA now, I think, right?
Yeah.
But it's not like you're sitting around in your bedroom waiting for the phone and all the phone rings and says, hey, do you want to, you know, you're out there saying, hey, man, let's put this shit together.
Yeah.
You know, you gotta hustle, man.
Whenever like young musicians or guitarists ask me about advice, I'm like, man, do your stuff and get it out there. Don't just practice in your bedroom.
Yeah.
I mean, practice is important, but you know, create concepts, see them out. Some are going to fail and some will do well, but you have to stay active and proactive. And you know, I mean, I think being a sideman is great, but there's way more longevity in being an artist, you know, and I've never knocked guitarists that go out and do side gigs for people.
Sure, sure.
Great. You know, and there's an art to that. But when you create your own music and you're a writer and a composer, and also it's going to help, you know, you pay for your kids to go to school eventually.
Yeah.
So it's important to be, you know, be an artist and write and create your bands and create your albums, you know. So.
And I would imagine at some, you probably need a little more, I don't want to take anything away from being a sideman. You need a different kind of courage to be willing to be more vulnerable that as an artist, as opposed to a sideman.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Where did you grow up? Because you've mentioned Brooklyn. I know you're in LA now. Where'd you originally grow up?
Till I was about 13, I was in Connecticut. So, but just outside of it was basically the suburbs of New York City, Fairfield County.
Oh,
yeah. So he would commute to the city.
Toad's Place.
I moved around after that. What's that?
Toad's Place.
Yep. I played Toad's Place a lot. So yeah, I was always like, and then I was in New York City, and then I was in Boston, and like I said, I was in Western Mass, and then I moved to Brooklyn full time in 99, and then was there till just this earlier this year. I moved to LA in February.
What prompted you to move out to LA?
I really wanted to first, I mean, the weather, particularly winter. Yeah. I wanted to build my own studio here and really just like, I wanted more space. And you know, wanted to kind of get into the, doing the production thing here.
Good for you.
It's been going really well. I've been, you know, producing a lot here, writing a lot, you know, trying to get more into doing stuff for film and TV. And, so it just seemed like more opportunity for me here. And, you know, I travel, I was working in New York, but I didn't need to be in New York City. And, you know, just living, like, it was just getting to me, you know, just the everyday, the quality of life there.
It's tough.
It's a hustle, man. It's a grind.
Yeah.
And I love New York City, and I love going there now and visiting. But, you know, it's one of those things where just, you know, my life is better here.
No, I get it. I'm from the Bronx, so believe me, you're preaching to the choir, man.
Yeah.
Tell me some of the low points or dark periods you've had to deal with and how you got through them.
Oh man, there's definitely been a few. There was definitely a period where kind of Soul Live was slowing down, and I was just trying to figure out the next move. And you know, I actually did move to LA or attempted to back in like the mid 2000s, and came back to New York and didn't know what my next move was. And you know, I'm just like that, you know, which eventually turned into me wanting to be a solo artist. You know, but it took me a while to get the nerve up to do that, you know, and I didn't know what to do because the bands that I were in weren't really doing what we wanted to be doing. And, you know, the late labels in the world started dipping, and the whole industry was changing, and it was streaming, and, you know, the producing world was hard because I'd had some success as a producer, where we made some money, and I'd kind of taken that money and invested it in having a studio and all these things. And then that was dwindling, and like, you know, no one was hiring us. I mean, that was the moment when I was like, okay, we need to start our own label. We need to sign our own artists, start developing our own thing. And, you know, I need to start developing myself as an artist too, outside of the bands.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, it was like, it's those moments, those low points that really make you kind of figure your shit out. You
yeah,
know?
Man.
At that point, I kind of thought, oh, I'm just going to keep, you know, I hadn't had a record for 50 Cent that had made some money and with Adam. And we placed a bunch of records with like pretty big, like hip hop artists. But then when that started to dive, the industry wasn't paying for producers anymore. I realized, well, I need to create my own opportunities here, yeah. not just keep, you know, hoping that people use me on their records. We need to create our own records. And that was when I first met Nigel and started to make his record with him. And that was when Soul Live kind of got out of our deal and started making our own records. And we started building our own thing, you know, which, you know, has been valuable for us now, but it was hard in the beginning. Cause all of a sudden we didn't have any labels giving us money. We didn't have anyone supporting us, you know, and we kind of ran out of all our resources. So we had to kind of bond together and say, okay, we're going to invest in each other. Just put all of our time and energy into supporting each other, you know?
Thanks, man. I appreciate you sharing that. I think it's important too, because I think often people, you know, life, it doesn't spare anybody.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, Soul Live was winding down. I didn't know what to do. That's a tough and everybody that works for themselves, myself included, has been there, yeah. Man. But it is in those tough moments where you say, okay, I'm forced to make a decision. The shit I'll get off the pot, what is that going to look like? And, you right. know, you make the decision, man. So thank you, yep. man.
Absolutely.
Anything, if you could go back and give advice to younger Eric, anything you would have told yourself, assuming you'd listen, that would make your life easier, business, personal, anything?
Yeah. You know, I would say again, investing in yourself, You know, luckily I did buy an apartment when I had money early on, and that was the best investment I ever did. And
right on, man.
I would do more of that. When you have those opportunities, don't just cherish them, but like invest in your future.
Yeah.
Because, you know, sometimes you just feel bulletproof. Like when I was 25, I was like, oh, I'm going to be rich and all these things are going to happen. But I didn't know that like the record industry was going to tank and that these other bands might fall apart and whatever. So I think like not only value success when it's happening, but also just appreciate the process and enjoy yourself along the way. Appreciate the people around you. Tell them you appreciate them. You know what I mean? Express that. I think that's really important. Create a family that is going to sustain, you know, musical and personal. And, you know, if you take care of the people around you and appreciate them, your life's just going to be better. You know, gratitude is huge.
Yeah, gratitude is huge, man.
That's something you figure out with age, too.
You know,
it's like when the more you appreciate what you've got, the more blessings you have.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny how that works, isn't it?
Yeah.
Tell me, let's talk about gear for a few minutes. You got some awesome looking hollow body and semi-hollows there, man. Yeah. What's your number one and what guitars would round out your top three?
Right now, I'd say the top, I have a signature model with Ibanez.
Great. You have two, don't you?
Model. Yeah, two. And so I use the EKM 100 and the EKM 10T are the two, but the 100 is what I've been using, and I have a tricked out one where I've done a bunch of weird stuff too and messed with the pickups. And so that's like my main soul live guitar. But I love that for everything, you know, and it's a beast. And so I play that a lot. I've been playing this PRS Silver Sky a lot.
Yeah.
The Strat.
Yeah, the new one.
I have this one right here, this blue one, that they just sent me this kind of recently, which kills, man. That thing is amazing.
How is that different from a Fender Strat?
It's similar. I mean, it's like a 64 Strat is what they kind of based it on, but man, what they did with the pickups and the neck feels amazing. And it just sings, man. It's pretty amazing. And then, you know, it's the first number three. It's hard to say. I have a 67 335 that I dig. And then I have an SG that Derek Trucks gave me years ago that definitely is a beast of a guitar. I play that a lot too.
What kind of pickups are
this weekend? I did the Allman Revival.
Yeah.
Mini tour this weekend. And I was going to bring the SG, but I knew everyone else was. So I have a 59. VOS, like a custom shop Les Paul that I played this week. That thing rips too.
That's cool, man. So
I guess that's four or five that I said now, but it's right now between the Ibanez and the Silver Sky is where you'll mostly see me on.
Yeah. Yeah. How is your Ibanez different than like a 335 or maybe it's not.
It's not that different. The pickups are different. The neck's different. The body is slightly different. It's based on like the Schofield AS200, which I played for a long time, and we just kind of tricked it out. We added a Bigsby. It's all like pretty detailed stuff. The neck's a little beefier, and the it's got some cool little design stuff on it, and it screams, has really hot pickups, which I dig.
That being said, your tone is really warm.
Yeah.
Yeah, you tend to gravitate more of like, I'm not going to say a British brown sound, but your tone is very warm. You're not, you know, like Steve Vai or anything like that.
Right,
you know,
right.
You know, it's a very
warm. Yeah, I kind of go back and forth. I mean, the Strat has been getting me a little bit, I've been digging into more of a, of like the bridge pickup on that and kind of screaming a little bit, but yeah, I gravitate towards the warm sound, especially, I mean, that the Ibanez really, but it's kind of, it's cool because the Ibanez can kind of get that growly tone, but I can also get like a Grant Green kind of jazzy box sound. That's why I love that guitar, because I can kind of get anything out of it.
Dude, believe me, you're preaching to the choir, bro.
Oh yeah. Ooh, nice. Wow, what year is that one?
Man, it's like 2013.
Okay,
but what happened was, it looks like a vintage because I bought it from a guy who happened to work at Gibson. I found it up in Nashville. He put the Bigsby in it, and he put that little custom made thing there. So it looks like an old vintage and it's got the dot. Yeah, but it's not. But for me, I love it. It just feels wonderful.
Cool.
Love that guitar, man.
I like that. That's cool.
If you remember this, what guitar were you playing on Out of Here, which is Lettuce's first album in 2000?
Actually,
let's do it.
This guy.
You got
this was one of the first ones that Ibanez gave me.
That was such a great tone and sound on that, man. I was just...
I think so out of tune. I haven't played it in a while. But yeah, I used this on Out of Here and probably those first solo. I had this one and then I had a blonde one too that I played a lot during that time.
So funky,
but this
man.
One's pretty cool because it's got this single coil tap, so I could like get a stratty kind of sound too.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I'm gonna start
playing this again more because
dude, it sounds so funky, man.
Yeah.
Do you happen to know Jimmy James? He's a guitar player. He's from Seattle. He plays funk. He's with Delvon Lamar's trio, and he's also with a band.
Oh, yeah.
He gets a tone sort of like you on that particular record. It was funny because he's really into old school funk, and that record was, you know, your record was just, that was so, cool. So great, man. I really love the tone on that. Yeah.
This is the SG,
that's the one that Derek gave you?
Yeah, and this one, this was like one of the first when they were working on a signature model for him. Like, they sent him a bunch to try, and I was down there, and we picked this one out of like a stack of a few. And this one sings too, man.
I'm always amazed when he plays how sensitive he's constantly adjusting the tone knobs constantly, like all night long.
You know, it's really the volume knob. Because what he does is he just takes the super and cranks it, and then all the gain, he'll go between like 2 and 10. So he doesn't adjust. He has no pedals.
Right.
There's no pedals whatsoever, and he is adjusting the. I mean, sometimes the tone, but it's really mostly the volume, and he's just adjusting a little bit, little bit, little bit.
Yeah.
And then the end of the solo. But it's interesting because with the SG and the Super Reverb, it's not changing the volume as much as you might think. It's changing the
bite.
Gain.
Yeah.
The bite, you're hearing more distortion the more he pulls that volume up.
But he's constantly doing
cool
it.
Thing. I've been doing that a little bit more too lately. Like not just if I have, it's all about having a great amp though. And I do so much flying that I have to bring some pedals to enhance that. But for him, he usually has either his old super or this guy, Alessandro, makes these kind of beefed up supers for him, and he'll just crank it and then this adjusts the, you know, the kind of the gain of the situation.
Yeah. What's your favorite song you wrote?
Oh man, that's a tough one. Whew. I don't know. Man, that's a tough question. I've never been asked before, I don't think.
That's good. Thank God.
I don't think I've ever asked me that. I mean, right now, I don't know. Maybe because we've been talking about it. All at Once. I like All at Once.
It's a beautiful.
You know, I like a lot of the songs in the new record. Actually, you know what? I'm going to say Carry My Name off the new record.
Off a Telescope.
I don't know if you heard that one. But
I did.
That's five star. Yeah,
it's a great track, man.
That's also because it's kind of recent. So, and that one's basically about passing down generation to generation, you know, which I initially wrote about my dad and my grandfather. But I also pitched it to Marcus because his dad and him have a similar connection. And that whole passing down of the music thing. But then it made perfect sense with this record because, one of the characters has a mom who's passing away. And so that song kind of outlines their relationship. So that's, that's kind of what that one's about.
So, what's the best guitar and best amp you've ever played?
I have a Super Reverb, a 65.
Oh, wow.
That also I got from Derek. It was an Alessandro amp. I think the combination of this guitar with that amp is pretty amazing, but exactly what Derek does, you know. There's a couple there's two guitars, like two like kind of dream guitars that I want to own. One is a 61 335 that I played in Brooklyn at Retro Fret, and I almost sold everything I owned to buy it. It just screamed, and I was like, oh my God. And when I went back, luckily it was gone actually, because I would have broke, because it was just like one of the most, it was like over 20 grand. And then,
that's crazy, man. That's a lot of dough for a guitar.
I know. And then Ross James, my friend, actually, So Ross has a 64 Strat,
right,
that Phil gave him. And that one of the, I don't know, I gotta see if he still has it, because I almost tried to buy that from him a little while. And that could happen at some point. But the 63, 64 Strats, you know, those are amazing. I have a Nash guitar, which is like a 63 copy. I'll bring that. It's this guy, which is amazing.
That's guitar. Really nice, man.
Yeah, but it's not, you know, it's a copy. It's great, but they did a great job, but I would love to own an original. Ross has a really great one. I picked up Ross's 64 at Soundcheck, and I was like, it just like blew me away.
He's a lovely guy, man. He's a really sweet guy. Yeah,
I
love Ross.
I just saw him a couple of days ago. I was in Denver on Sunday.
Oh, that's cool. How's his Bob Dylan thing working out? Is that going well?
Good. Yeah, I'm hoping that I might do some of those gigs at some point. We'll see.
Awesome.
But he's excited about it. I think it's going to be cool.
Tell me, knee-jerk reaction, top three Desert Island discs.
Whew. Axis Bold is Love, Jimi Hendrix. Maybe George Harrison, All Things Must Pass.
Oh, what a record, man.
Yeah. Huh.
That was like a three-record set, I think, right?
And maybe like Zeppelin. I almost want to say Zeppelin 3, but it might be 2. Let's say 3, because I love that like weird acoustic stuff they did on that record.
Good choices, man.
Yeah.
Best decision you ever made?
Oh, that's a tough one. I would say moving to California was big for me. And it was a tough decision, because it was a lot of changes and a lot of, it was a big, big mountain to move for me.
Yeah.
But since I've moved here, you know, I'm in a beautiful house. You know, I'm in love. I have a new girlfriend that I'm like super happy. I'm, you know, just, it's, my life changed tremendously from that decision.
Good for you, man. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Tell me the most important things you've learned about yourself.
Oh man, these are tough, man.
I could ask you about string gauge if you want.
No. These are better. You know, I guess. Okay. What I'm gonna say is that. What the biggest thing, the most important thing that I learned was that in my last 20, 30 years is that the most important thing is how I react to things and not what things are actually happening.
Ain't that the truth, man?
So like when I finally learned that when like the flight gets canceled or like, you know, the amp breaks or whatever thing happens there. They're all little things in the grand scheme. And it's like, I used to, you know, if you decide to freak out about it, it's only making everything worse. And when you're on the road and you're a musician, there's a million things you can freak out about. And when you finally figure out that, like, you can kind of laugh it all off, you know what I mean? Like, oh, this happened. Okay, cool. Well, then there's always, like, it's never the end of the world, you know, in those situations. It's like, and once you kind of learn that, you're just happier. You know, it's just like when you realize, okay, well, you know, if that guitar broke, oh, well, I'll play a different one. Or, oh, that venue is flooded. Oh, well, we'll cancel, we'll play the next time, or we'll play over here. Or maybe I've usually found out that when you have a good outlook on things and a positive attitude about things, like, stuff works out in your
head. Yeah, it does, you know? Man.
You just got to don't freak out. Is what I would say. Just don't freak out about anything.
You know who Frank Marino is? Mahogany Rush?
I know that name.
He's a pretty popular guitar player, like, let's say, in the 70s. Plays an SG with Strat pickups. Anyway, I had him on the show, and I said, Frank, any famous last words? And he goes, yeah, it's never as bad as you think. Yeah. And that's exactly what you're saying, man. It was a very good way to end the show. Yeah, it was a good way to end the show. This is another tough one. What do you like most about yourself?
That I like to laugh, you know, I like to laugh, and I'm generally in a good mood.
That's great. You have to be, you wouldn't be working with hundreds and hundreds of people otherwise. 'Cause like you just said, it's a lot better in general when you're positive.
Yeah.
Yeah. So best childhood memory.
Childhood memory. That's a good one, but it might take me a second.
Yeah, man.
I remember going to my first concert. I think it was Hot Tuna, which I was really into them, but I remember going to my first concert and seeing the crowd react. I was 10 years old or something, seeing the crowd react to this music and seeing, you know, these musicians on a big stage. And I just, that moment kind of changed my life. Yeah.
That was kind of when you knew this is what I want to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Or at least I got excited about it. I think it was a couple years later when I actually could play a little bit that I kind of realized that and maybe jamming with my brother's band or something. And then I remember seeing he brought me to see the Grateful Dead when I was 12.
Right.
And I saw, and that blew my mind, because just seeing all this massive crowd and just seeing this kind of community around this band blew my mind.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
Yeah.
Did you ever get to play with Jorma?
No, but I've spoken to him about it a bunch of times.
I was curious.
So it's kind of weird that I'm trying to think if I've ever been on stage with him. I mean, I've met him a bunch of times, and he has asked me to do his Fur Peace Ranch, and it hasn't worked out timing wise, but I plan to do it at some point.
But you told him that was the first band. Did you tell him that experience?
I think I've told him that. Yeah. Yeah,
that's cool, man.
Yeah, I think I told him that at Lockenfest when they played. Yeah.
Do you have any hobbies outside of music?
You know, not enough. My hobbies are all music. I'm not just a guitarist, but it's all music related. You know, I like outdoor stuff, hiking and, you know, being outside, and, you know, I'm not super into sports, but, you know, I play a little basketball and, you know, not a ton.
Yeah.
Not a ton.
It's tough.
I need one. Now that I'm in California, I do hike a lot out here in California, but, you know, I like to fish, actually. I went fishing with Derek actually recently down in Georgia, and,
bass fishing.
So I've got a few, but not, what's that?
Bass fishing on a lake.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so relaxing, man. That's really relaxing. Two more questions, man. Tell me a specific experience that changed your life or changed the way you think about things.
That's a good one. I don't know if I can nail that down to a specific thing. I mean, I guess, working with the Grateful Dead guys, to be totally honest, changed my thought process. Again, it kind of goes back to what we said before, is all the great players that I know, and this also, this is a little bit broader than I think the question you asked me, but you know, actually, I will pin it down to a specific thing. John Scofield came in once to play with us, and this kind of relates to the other guys that really, the guys that really have longevity know how to come into a situation. And again, make the best out of what's happening. And I remember there was an amp and the reverb didn't work and it kind of was messed up. And Scofield's reaction was like, oh man, that's going to make me do some totally different stuff. You know? And I remember being like, cause like I would have, at that point in my life, I would have bitched about that. You know what I mean? I would have been like, oh, the amp, they brought me the wrong amp. And oh my God, it sounds blah, blah. But he was kind of like, oh man, I'm going to be able to like do some wholly different things and make me think differently. It's going to make me do something different. And I remember like that was kind of a changing moment. Cause I was like, oh man, you know, especially if there's nothing you can do about it, you got to take the positive away from it. And if it's going to make you play different, maybe you'll be able to create in a different way. And I've thought about that moment many times afterwards, even though he probably doesn't even remember that.
Sure.
Where I'm like, oh man, well maybe I can use this weird sound that I have right now to do something kind of quirky and different that I wouldn't normally do. And I think you can apply that to not just guitar playing.
So he's inherently seeing the glass half full effectively.
Exactly.
Wow. That's really cool. That is a big like aha moment there, man. It's nice and simple. That's really good.
Yeah.
And last question, man, what's the biggest change in your personality, Eric, over like the last 10 years? And how much that has been an intentional change and how much is just a natural part of aging?
I think, again, the theme here is, I mean, I just being easy about things, you know, not making a fuss about things, being easy to work with. And, you know, I guess one other thing I'll add to that is being good at communicating with people. You know, because I think another problem that I've had in the past or people have is not expressing yourself. You know, once you know how to express yourself in a way that's not going to offend people and just being generally a nice person about things, you can get your point across. You know what I mean? And not, you know, so I think one of the things I've learned in the last few years is like, if I don't want to do a gig or if it doesn't fulfill me musically, just don't do it. You know what I mean? Because if you decide to do it and then you're a jerk about it, no one's happy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, you know, I think communicating well and being easy to work with, the combination of those two, and you're going to do well, you know.
Was there anything specific that helped you learn how to communicate in a better way for yourself?
Because
usually that's learned. It's not like, if you don't, unless you have it.
It's definitely learned. I mean, I think it's in certain cases, you know, relationships that I've been in, whether, you know, or whether it's bandmates or girlfriends or whatever it is, you know, and learning from those, what worked and what didn't work, you know?
Yeah.
Soul Live's been a band for 20 years. And, you know, we've had to shake things up to communicate. Sometimes we got to be like, come on, guys, let's talk. And I'm very much that type of person. I want to talk about everything. I want to, like, put it all out there, probably because when I've seen negative effects when I don't do that.
Yeah.
Whether it's bands or, like I said, or relationships.
Definitely.
So I think that's really it. It's just seeing what, you know, okay, well, this worked. And this didn't, you know, and generally it came down to like communicating everything, you know, and I think that's huge.
Well, dude, you're also a great communicator on your guitar. So thank you very much for that, man.
Appreciate that.
Let me tell people some of the stuff you got going on, and thank you very much for time, man. I know how busy you are. I really appreciate it. Thank you for making time. All right. If you don't know Eric Krasno, please check him out. It's Eric, E-R-I-C, Krasno with a K, K-R-A-S-N-O. And he's got a really complete website at erickrasno.com. Also, follow him on Instagram. Everything is at Eric Krasno, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Things to look out for, his Eric Krasno E3, as he mentioned, the Eric Krasno Trio. Soul Live has some gigs coming up in February in Pittsburgh, Boston, Buffalo, and I think one other place. I don't remember.
Then New York City. Well, actually, Capitol Theater in Portchester, New York, too.
Awesome. The Capitol Theater in Portchester. O'Teal and Friends, they're going out. Eric's part of those guys in April. And New Orleans Jazz Fest with O'Teal.
There's a bunch of Yeah, O'Teal's doing that. I'm doing a project with Marcus King while I'm down there. Soul Live is playing. Again, all of that will be at ericcrasno.com/tour.
Awesome. The Cleaners, look for them in New Orleans, right? Hey, man, let me wrap this up. Any final words or anything I missed or anything else you want to catch up on or let people know about?
No, I just want to say thanks for having me on, and it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, man. I wish you the best of everything. Hang on one second. Let me say goodbye to everybody. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Please check out Eric Krasno. Man, let me just tell you, if nothing else, listen to Telescope, which is under Kraz, K-R-A-Z, and Blood from a Stone. They will change your musical landscape, man. There's some stuff on there that you have not heard in a long, long time that's played this well and very original, and it's just got a great funky soul, psychedelic jazz vibe. Everything's working on those records, man. You cannot go wrong. So please check those out. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. Eric, thanks for everything, brother.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.